This is Ed McMahon. It's That's Life with Mark Snyder. And now, ladies and gentlemen, here's Mark.
We are speaking live right now with Bob Cousill.
Hi, Mark.
The well-known Cousills. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
You know, it's hard to believe all these years have gone by since the 60s. It seems
they
like yesterday.
Faster and faster.
Doesn't it seem like yesterday still?
It does. It does. It seems like today.
That's amazing. I mean, I grew up listening to songs like The Rain, the Park, and Other Things.
It's funny. The Rain, the Park, and Other Things, to me, actually stood the test of time. It's still a good record.
I think it is.
And it I had to wait till I got older to appreciate that. Because when you're a kid, you don't care.
That's true.
It is true.
But, I mean, you know, I can still hear, I saw her sitting in the rain. By the way, where did the song's title come from?
Well, the guys who wrote that song, Artie Kornfeld, he was our producer at Mercury Records when I was in the 10th grade back in, like, 65. And Mercury dropped us, and they had written that song, and they were going to call it The Flower Girl, which made sense to me.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, I saw this lead sheet in the studio say The Rain, The Park, and Other Things, which to me was a very kind of hippie kind of title. I remember Bill and I were saying, well, why don't you just call it The Flower Girl? And, you know, this is cooler. This is neater. And I remember somebody at MGM, which was the record company we were with at the time, being concerned that that song title might not be good enough to keep it in the memories of the kids when they hear it. And everyone wanted it to be called The Flower Girl.
Well, because that was the chorus.
I love The Flower Girl. Yeah. Well, naturally, you know. But it worked out. It worked out.
It did, I guess. They knew what they were doing in the first place.
I guess they did.
Mm. Yeah, of course, the other songs you did, Indian Lake and Hair, which were big hits, of course, short titles, easy to remember.
Yeah, Indian Lake was a funny song for us, Mark, because Bill and I, we did not like Indian Lake. We didn't write Indian Lake. Tony Romeo wrote that. The guy wrote, like, I Think I Love You for the Partridge Family and all that.
Mm-hmm.
We, as teenagers, didn't think it was hip enough. But MGM, again, they knew what they were doing in the summer of 68, put that thing out, and we had a big summer hit that year. And we were out on tour all summer with that, and there were Indian Lakes everywhere. And they all wanted to know, is this the Indian Lake of the song? And they would call and have us visit their Indian Lake. I do think specifically it was written for an Indian Lake in upstate New York, is where Tony lived, and he wrote it, so I assume it was from up there. But those were our big ones. Hair was the biggest, of course.
We
just locked onto the whole phenomenon of Hair when we ended up recording that song.
You know, one of the things that really stands out when I look back at the Cousills, and I didn't know all this stuff. You know, none of us know what's going on. That's the interesting thing. When a group is out there like the Jacksons or the Osmonds or anybody else, we don't know what's going on behind closed doors.
Mm-hmm.
We only know what we see on stage. We saw the Cousills singing these happy songs and looking happy. And I don't know how happy your childhood was, but from what I've read, your father was kind of a tough guy.
Dad was tough. Dad grew up in the military. Look, our dad and mom were wild teenagers, and they had to get married at 15 and 16, and she had Bill when she was 16, and these were wild people.
Mm.
And all my father knew was the military, and he had gone to the 7th grade and dropped out and joined the Navy, and 20 years in the Navy, and his military tactics that served so well, served the country well, he assumed would serve his family well. And it was hard, to be candid with you. It was difficult growing up under that kind of situation. It made it very tense. It made it, you know, our music was probably, I would have to say, our escape. And because when it came to the music, Bill and I and the other guys and Sue, you know, we kind of were in charge of that because we didn't know what we were doing. Bill and I had started playing guitar and singing together when we were 7 and 8 years old.
Mm-hmm.
So his style was harsh. He was a rough task maker. I will tell you that it was that stubbornness and that go-get-it kind of attitude that brought this thing to New York and to MGM and got it going, but it's probably the thing that killed it also, because in the end, yeah, when the business broke up, the family broke up, because and that was our sacrifice. You sacrificed your family for, it became business, is what happens. And so you're operating under that premise. And but it was great when we were in the studio or touring and on stage. That was the best time of our lives. It was at the best.
It seems like you would be making a ton of money during all this stuff. What happened to all that money?
Well, we did make a ton of money during all that stuff. We had great, fantastic contracts with like the American Dairy Association. We endorsed a product, milk, which was kind of unique back then, but we did it. And
right.
We had great hits and toured all the time. We made millions and millions and millions of dollars. It's well documented what we did. We also lost millions and millions and millions of dollars.
Mm.
And I know that's not supposed to happen this day and age, and there's laws to prevent it. But, you know, I mean, Dad did the best he could, but investments were poor. The management of money, look, we were a small Newport, Rhode Island family, military family. We were talented, but when we hit New York, I mean, you jump from Newport to New York, man. I just have to tell you that I don't think anyone knew what they were doing in terms of the business part of this. Now I'm 16, 17, 18. Certainly, I'm not monitoring anything. And when we became of age, and that would be like 21, by then it was ending, and we found out that really there was no money. You know, you just shrugged it off, some of us, and said, geez, well, what do you know about that, you know? Where other, I have brothers, Barry and Bill, for instance, who took that pretty hard, because that's a pretty fall, that's a pretty long drop from the top like that to the bottom with nothing left over.
Mm-hmm.
And so whatever the Jackie Coogan laws and all that stuff, well, what are we going to do, sue our parents? Now, I know that's not unheard of.
Not anymore, but back then it would have been.
Yeah, we weren't of that composure to do that. This was life's experiences, and like, all right, everyone, pull your bootstraps up and get to work.
I just thought it was amazing. I saw an interview, and Richard, your twin brother, was quoted as saying, we weren't a family, we were elements in a production my father was staging.
I think that was well put by Richard. Although, we brought the production to him. You know what I mean? The kids, me and Bill and Barry and John, that foursome especially, from the time we were 7, 8, 9 years old, and it was Everly Brothers, then it was like the Beatles. And we were a functioning unit that was writing songs at a young age, playing around Newport, going up to Brown University for frat parties when we were in 10th, 11th graders, signing with Mercury Records and putting out records that, okay, they weren't successful, but for kids that young to be doing that, that's pretty good. It was when we had a sense that something bigger could happen that our dad retired from the Navy and took the helm to try and steer this thing to New York and see if we can't make the big time. No one was arguing that, but he was a control person. He controlled everything. And in that, and that kind of points to that kind of a quote where we were just the players in this bigger production. That's true, but I would have to say that we were willing players. And Richard has a different perspective because of the 7 children, 6 are on the Ed Sullivan Show with their mom, and he wasn't, because he and my dad never saw eye to eye, and they conflicted from the beginning, and he was never allowed in at all, which is what he's had to deal with. So, you know, he never got the millions to lose, so that's a whole different, it's quite the story, let me tell you, this family.
And I understand that Bill at one point, wasn't he the leader of the group?
Bill and I would have to tell you, we co-wrote songs, we co-produced, we co-wrote everything till the age of 7, but I would have to admit that, you know, I was his understudy.
Well, he was the big brother.
More than he, because he was the big brother.
Right. And he sang lead on Hair.
Oh, he sang, well, I tell you, he sang the intro in the first verse, but I sing the second, Paul sings the third. We're all singing lead on Hair. We just so genetically are so alike, you can't really tell if you weren't didn't know it, you know.
Well, the reason I'm thinking this is I understand that at one point Bill was caught smoking pot by your dad and was thrown out of the group.
That's a well-documented tale that Bill and Dad did have that falling out, and he... I'll tell you something, Mark. That was a morning we were leaving for Texas to go on tour that happened. And he tossed him right there. That was the end of it. And that was the beginning of the end of the Cow Seals.
And you became the leader, right? I mean, de facto, you were
the
leader.
By default.
Yeah.
You know, it's like we still, 2 hours later, the rest of us still got on an airplane and flew to Texas and started that tour. I took over the lead vocals, and we just, I have to admire, when I think back on it, the flexibility of this operation, because there's a lot of groups, if you did that to the lead singer, that group's not going anywhere on tour that morning. But we pulled it off and did it, and I inherited the complete artistic reins at that point. I was 19. I wasn't ready for it, to be honest, and I just think that was the beginning of the end. MGM dropped us eventually. London Records picked us up. We put out two albums, which really are just records of me trying to figure out how to produce and write songs alone, and they sound it. And London eventually dropped us. And like I say, we were at our peak at the time that happened. Hair had been very big for us. 3 million is sold, number one record. We were in the middle of a live and concert album when it happened, and we were just about to leave on tour when it happened.
Why didn't, you know, like your mom and the rest of you guys all get together and say, Dad, you know, you can't do this?
No one did that. You did not do that. You weren't raised that way. Mm-hmm. Mom, to sum mom up, she was the eighth child. Mm-hmm. And she did not go against this man. Now, you know, was there a lot of abuse in the house? Not that I saw between mom and dad, but he was the control person. And you just kept quiet, got on the plane, and made the best of a bad situation. That's what you did.
Hmm. And one of the things that I talk about on the show all the time, and we touched upon it earlier in this interview, we have some of the biggest stars of the 60s and 70s and 80s on it, some who are faded from sight. There's a quote in the story I read here that says that you say that almost overnight you went from living a very fine life to sweeping a garage for a day job.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't that make you, you know, when you look back at it, doesn't that make you a stronger individual as you go on after that?
It did me personally, yes, because when it ended, I was okay with that. I sold all my musical equipment. It's all I had ever known my entire life, and I was about to embark on a part of my life where I didn't have that. Because if you do that from the age of 7, and you really do, and you're a ninth grader in high school in 10th and 11th, and you're playing at Dorian's in Newport Thursday, Fridays, and Saturdays, and you're just, all you want, you live just to learn the next Beatles song and to play in this band, and then you make it, you're famous. You have everything you ever wanted. You live that for about 5 years. It's tremendous. It's incredible. And then, boom, you lose it. It's over. It's done. The family's broken up, and you're on your own, and you're 21. I think the fact that I was 21, I think I got excited. I said, yeah, let's rock, man. What's next? You know, I would have liked to have money.
Mm.
The absence of financial stability was a problem that haunted us a bit, because that was a harsh drop. But I had no problem walking away, although I never stayed away.
Usually, though, people who drop like that, always in the back of their minds want to get back up there again.
You
and do as much as you can and do whatever you have to do to get back there again. Did you have that feeling, and do you still have it?
Yeah, I still have it, but I didn't have it at the immediate time that it all fell apart. I was just sort of relieved that the tension was gone, and we had a good ride, and I thought that the music was changing anyway and may have been leaving us behind anyway, although who knows, I could have evolved with it. But after, yeah, like about after 5 years went by, and I thought, well, you know, I would still write songs, see, and it's something I've done since age 12. And right, you haven't tasted it. Yeah, there is this desire to go get it again. But you know the statistics if you do that. You can count on two hands the ones who pull it off. And we have yet to pull it off even. And we've, in the late 70s we tried, Paul, John, Susan, and I, with Chuck Plotkin, who was a producer at the time with Electro Asylum. We made a very good record that never was released. It just never panned out. I've tried in the 80s, but these decades were difficult because musically they were aimless, it seemed to us. There was, you know, the 70s and 80s, it was disco in the 70s and, you know, Eagles in the 80s or whatever, and there wasn't a lot going on. The 90s, to us, is a decade that has tremendous potential, so that the feeling of, you know, we can do this, it comes back stronger, because you go, we can do this, and we think there's an audience for it.
Mm-hmm. You have a CD called Global,
yes,
which is released from Robin Records,
yes,
and it can be ordered from robinrecords.com or cowsills.com.
Yes.
Cowsill, not plural, .com.
Either one will work.
Okay. But it's amazing, this CD. I was listening to it a few times now, and I'm hearing, it doesn't sound like the Cowsills at all. In fact, some of the cuts I'm looking sound like the Starship. Some of them sound like Fleetwood Mac. You guys have really progressed quite a bit.
Yes, these are our roots. See, what happened was, my pursuit was how to write songs, okay, personally. And it's if you're a songwriter and you don't know what you're doing, I had many frustrating years. Chuck Plotkin was helpful, very helpful to me in about songwriting. And our roots were always Fleetwood Mac and the Beach Boys and the Beatles and the Eagles and whatnot. And this Global, to us, is what we would have evolved to, and what we did evolve to, even if we had stayed the Cowsills and stayed kind of out there the way some of them could, you know, and survive. You know, we never did the oldies circuit. We almost did, but we just decided not to. Susan could barely relate to that because she was only 7 or 8 years old when it was big time in the late 60s, you know, and she's a nice young woman who has a great voice now. So Global is where we would have ended up, because we did continue to record and we did continue to write and make music and evolve our sound. It's just we never could sign to a label. We could never get signed, so no one ever heard it. But we still nonetheless did it. It's just we never really thought anyone would hear it. But this day and age, with the internet and with the idea that, you know what, we need to finish this record. We need to get in the studio and do this. We can't wait around for some major label to sign us, thinking they're going to do it for us. That's not how it works these days.
No, not at all.
There's only 4 major labels left.
Right.
So you have to take control. And the internet, I will tell you, to us, represented a playing field where we can, at a minimum, go out there and state our case. Bring it to the people, quote unquote. And lo and behold, that's exactly what we've been doing for a year and a half. Global is not on the radio yet, because you're not going to get to the radio through the internet. But you're going to build your case and get it out there and be able to open shop and take it to a certain level that before you could never have taken it to. You know, we present a complete package to somebody now. We've got the record made. We've tested the market. Radio has been receptive to it. The reviews have been 100% wonderful. We're humbled by that. Thank you. We're so glad that it's receptive. Pop music is back. A lot of things are going on where the timing looks right now. The late 90s is just so excellent.
Mm-hmm.
Audiences aren't so narrow. In the late 60s, you had one set of radio stations. You either got on it or you didn't. Now you've got hip-hop next to pop, next to country rock, next to grunge, next to everything's coexisting.
Mm-hmm.
And their audiences are being discovered and found and catered to all at the same time. They have their own set of radio stations even. It's tremendous opportunity.
Yeah. We're going to actually, at the end of this interview, play a little bit of What About Love so the folks can understand where it sounds like and order it at the net.
We appreciate that. We are pop music lovers, and we are a power pop band, and our whole focus is pop music. And to us, well, what's pop music to us? It's big vocals, it's big harmonies, great melodies, great choruses, jangly guitars and keyboards and percussion, and just what we did.
Mm.
That's our definition of pop music. And it's all like when Poptopia called, which is the pop festival we're going to be playing, we say yes because that's us. Yeah, we're pop. Let's go.
Tell us a little bit about this Poptopia.
Poptopia is an annual festival where a lot of the great pop bands who aren't signed and who are supporting the movement and contributing to it get together in various locations, and we perform our music. For whoever wants to hear it. It's in San Francisco, it's in Boston, it's in San Diego. We're playing L.A., of course, at the Troubadour on February 5th. And it's a moment where we get to stand up and say, we are part of this movement. This is our contribution to this movement. We support it. We think pop music will always be here, and other things come and go, but there's always, it's all about the song in pop music to us. It's about the song. And, for instance, at Poptopia, we're going to play songs off of Global, and we're going to bring on different singers and some more people and to add to the music, because we created a very big sound in the studio for Global, because that's a studio record. We performed live many of these songs, but once we got in the studio, since we put ourselves there and there was no record company looking over our shoulders and no one telling us what to do, we did what we wanted. And that's why we're thrilled with Global, because this is our best. We're going to tell everybody, this is the best we can do.
Now, for folks that are going to go to see Poptopia in their area, because many people around the world listening to this, are you going to be selling the CDs at the concert?
You know, we will have CDs at the concert, but we will more likely be giving them away.
Really?
Yes, only because, to be honest, the money that we would make selling CDs at a concert like this is not the money we're interested in. And we would rather spread this music out and give samples of this away. They're just CDs. It's, you know, it's not a big deal. We're going to be at the Troubadour in Hollywood, you know, on February 5th, and it may hold 300 people. I don't know how many people go in there, but we're going to have a bunch of CDs. We're just going to give them to people because our pursuit is that this is Poptopia is a way just to show our music and share our music. We're not here to make money and pay our rent or anything. We're here to share music. So we're not going to have them on for sale, but those records, the CDs, will be there with us, and you can have one if you want. Just come up, and we'll give it to you.
Cool. So folks out there, I mean, San Francisco, L.A., any of those areas out there, you want to check out Poptopia. Do you know when you're going to be around Boston or the East Coast?
We almost get, well, I'll tell you something. The weekend of September 23rd, 24th, that third weekend of September, we'll be playing that Saturday and Sunday in Newport, Rhode Island at the Taste of Rhode Island Festival.
Oh, wow.
And it's going to be a very big reunion. We're going to try and get our brother Bill to come and join us. We haven't played with him in 30 years. Richard will be there, who's never been in the band. He's going to play percussion and join us on stage. Barry's going to join us, and we haven't played with him in 10 years. This is kind of, we've turned this into a family reunion, a council family group reunion. It'll be the first time we've all been together.
I'm going back home again.
Yeah, it's going back home.
Yeah, well, the first time, last time you guys have all been together was probably when your mom passed away, right?
I was just going to say that. That is the last time we saw each other, all seven children. And our parents are dead now. Dad died and Mom died, and this will be the first time we've been together since Mom passed away. And so you're talking many, many years, over 20.
Yeah.
So we're very excited about that, and that's when you're going. That's where you'll find us.
Well, I think that people will really enjoy that. And in addition to just being a nostalgia act, quote-unquote, you guys are creating some great new music.
You know, to be honest, we had 3 million sellers, okay, three big hits. And we almost, we were in Dick Clark's office before we recorded Global. We were going to sign a contract to jump on the bus with the Grassroots and Turtles and make some money that summer and sing those three songs. When it just, we just had this feeling that we're not done artistically, that, you know, look at Santana and Cher. It's like we are of the generation that kept going. We just pack it up because we turned a certain age. We're still producing good pop music, and there's an audience for it. They're us.
Yeah.
We're the audience.
That's right.
I'm looking all over the radio dial for the stuff I want, which is good pop music. It ended up being in country western for many years. Pop music lived there for a while. And now it's just so back. It's like when you hear Sheryl Crow and Hole and Alanis Morissette, they can call it what they want, but those are just good pop acts to me.
I agree with you. What did you guys think when the Partridge Family came on the air? It was rumored that they were based on your family, although very, obviously very, very loosely.
It was great. It was like we heard from the company, we heard from them first because they were going to use our group to be those kids. Which would be a natural, and they lived with us in Santa Monica for a little while, and a couple of issues surfaced. The number one, it was always going to be Shirley Jones was playing the mother, so that killed the deal for my dad. He wanted my mom to play the mom, so they wanted the kids but not the mother. Number two, when they finally met us in 1969, they realized, oh, these kids are growing up, because anyone that knows the Partridge Family sees what they were looking for, which was the Cowsills back in like 62, 63, when we were little guys playing frat parties But we were so young, people would just be blown away by it, you know, because we were pretty good live.
Mm-hmm.
So the deal fell through. They did take our record producer and Tony Romeo, who wrote Indian Lake. They took our team and borrowed that. They had everything but us. The whole story with the mom and the band, obviously, they candidly admit that that was inspired by us. There's a VH1 Behind the Music Now in the Partridge Family where we have a little segment because they're saying, well, there was a band like this, for those of you who don't know it. And Paul and I even did an interview piece for that, so you see that running now.
Mm.
It was great. We loved the show. It was okay that they didn't want us because Hair had been big right then at the time we were talking to them. So we're on top of the world. You know, so we're a bunch of kids with a hit record. We don't want to work every day. It was okay with us that it fell through. It was just another deal that fell through. But we were invited to the premiere. It was wonderful. And we thought the show was hilarious. We loved it.
You casually mentioned before about the Ed Sullivan show that everybody in the family was there mm-hmm. except Richard. What was that like to go on Ed Sullivan at that time?
It was the biggest thing that could happen to you in your life to go on the Ed Sullivan show back in 1967 or 68. It was the place to be. There was no MTV. There were no videos. The only way you were seen was on television. And Ed Sullivan was the place to be. The Beatles, Book 3 shows, it was live,
mm-hmm.
which was an adventure. And
what did you sing on the Ed Sullivan show? Do you remember?
Hmm?
What
did
you sing on that show?
We sang The Rain in the Park and other things the first time we were on. The second time we were on, we sang We Can Fly plus a Christmas medley because it was a Christmas show.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just fantastic meeting him because he was so famous to us, and the Beatles had played on that show, and that was very impressive to us because we were just teenagers, you know. And there was a party at his apartment after we were on, and it was just a big time.
Was Ed a nice guy?
Ed was great.
Yeah?
He was great. He was great because if he called you over after you sang on the Ed Sullivan show, this was an honor. And you only knew if that would happen if he did it because it was live.
Mm-hmm.
And he called us over, and we got to stand there like the Beatles did, and we were just going nuts. He called us over, you know. Otherwise, he goes, hey, let's hear it for me, and he doesn't do anything.
Mm.
It was the MTV of our day.
Well, that was similar, actually, to the Johnny Carson show, where a comedian would do a presentation, and he would sometimes invite them over to the couch.
Yes, when we did Carson probably four times. Finally, I think the last time he had us sit at his couch, or I think he had Mom. And yes, that was the same kind of honor. You felt very special by moves like that. It's fun.
Well, I'm thrilled to talk to you. We're talking to Bob Cousill, and again, the CD is called Global. We're going to hear a piece of it in just a minute. And if you want to order it, you can call. You can just go on the web at www.cousill.com or robinrecords.com. Either one will get it for you. And I want to wish you a lot of luck, and hopefully we'll speak
Thank
again.
Thank you so much.
Take care, Bob.
We're alive and well.
All right.
Talking to everybody.
Take care.
Okay, take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.